According to the New York Daily News, the COVID-19 pandemic in the U.S. continues to reach new levels after more than 3,100 deaths were recorded in the first day of December. As new cases have begun topping 200,000 a day, and the number of Americans hospitalized has topped 100,000. And as we head into the winter season, with dire predictions that things could get much worse if people don't follow precautions like wearing masks and practicing social distancing, new vaccines by Moderna, Pfizer, and BioNTech offer new hope that an end may be in sight. And at the same time, public trust in the vaccines remains relatively sketchy. A November Gallup poll showed that 58% of Americans said they would get a COVID-19 vaccine, and 42% said they would not. With the numbers broken down by ethnic groups, 54% of African Americans said they would get a vaccine, while 44% said they would not. Of Hispanic and white adults, 74% in both groups said they would, while a quarter said that they would not. For more on the complicated history of African-American distrust of vaccines, we're joined by Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Good morning, my dear sister. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Glad you're healthy.
Yes, yes. Hanging in there. So when it comes to all this new information about vaccines, as I mentioned before, African Americans are largely distrustful of them. Let's start with what we pretty much all know, but get us all on the same page. Talk about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. What was that? What happened?
Well, the Tuskegee experiment was technically from 1932 to 1972. 400 men were left untreated for syphilis, and they were tracked. They were traced to see the impact and effect of syphilis on their bodies. And even when an effective treatment of syphilis, penicillin, was discovered, these men who were never told that they had syphilis, they were told they had bad blood, you know, some vague kind of a description of their ailments. They were never told they had syphilis, and they were never administered a cure. In fact, on a couple of occasions when doctors who were not part of this federal experiment, in fact, did give men in the group treatment, unbeknownst to those doctors, they were chastised by those who were supervising the experiment. These brothers, many of them passed away. Of course, they had spouses and children. Frank Church, United States Senator, when he had the Church Committee 1972, this was uncovered. It was discussed. It was shut down ostensibly 1972, and a $10 million settlement was reached in 1974, and a commitment by the federal government to treat the survivors, their spouses, and their children. The last spouse of a victim of the so-called Tuskegee experiment transitioned in year 2009, and there are several children who are still alive who receive free medical care for the rest of their lives. But the Tuskegee experiment is just one in a long arc of assaults against Black people by this country and its agents, beginning before there was indeed the United States, going back to the first stages of settler colonialism.
Right, and those first stages, the large example that we know about is smallpox, with natives intentionally being given smallpox. Can you talk about that history?
Oh, sure. Very quickly. You know, it's interesting. John Fabian Witt has just published a book called American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law. And he starts with smallpox, and he divides this problem into two distinct areas, a sanitationist side and a quarantinist side. In other words, he says the white nationalists had a kind of sanitationist side. How do we treat disease? You try to help people. You try to improve their quality of life. You try to prevent them from getting sick. The quarantinist side says there are populations that you don't care about. So you might take overt action against them, or mm-hmm. you might just neglect them altogether. Mm-hmm. So the earliest examples we have, for example, you can go all the way back to 1662 when you see quarantine against natives, against enslaved people coming in for smallpox. And then you fast forward very quickly to 1721. There's an African named Onesimus who was actually in the Massachusetts colonies. He was enslaved by a dude named Cotton Mather, who was responsible for, among other things, the Salem witch trials, participated in it. Onesimus told them when a smallpox outbreak took over in Massachusetts, he said, I know how to cure this. In Africa, when we saw this, we would take a little bit of the disease, introduce it into someone, and they would, you know, generate an immunity. The first inoculations, in other words, come from an African who had seen the pox in West Africa and brought that expertise to America. But that didn't save the Africans, as you say. 40 years later, in the so-called French and Indian War, we see correspondence to Geoffrey Amherst, who was in Massachusetts, who said, and they say, you know, we can introduce this smallpox into blankets and give it to the Native Americans as a form of biological warfare. And so from that movement forward, you see this idea, this quarantine aside of controlling these non-black populations, and unfortunately, by the time we get to the 20th century, controlling some white populations as well through eugenics, sterilization, with the idea that some people don't deserve health care, shouldn't get health care, and in fact, biology can be used as a weapon against them.
And that speaks to another point that I was going to make about Margaret Sanger and founder of Planned Parenthood and her links to eugenics, the eugenics movement. The philosophy was that you can improve the human race and society by encouraging reproduction of some populations with desirable traits and discouraging reproduction in people with undesirable traits. And that whole movement.
That is exactly right. In fact, it's interesting, Janine, we think about this. People think today and say, you know, black folks, y'all got this irrational suspicion. No.
Right.
It's grounded in absolute historical experience. By the time we get to Margaret Sanger in the first quarter of the 20th century, you see immigrants coming from Europe who are considered too, quote unquote, damaged to reproduce. There's a case in 1927, Buck versus Bell, Carrie Buck, a white woman who was sterilized. Buck versus Bell has not been overturned as law. In fact, forced sterilization is still the practice in this country in select places. And by the time you get to the so-called eugenics movement, I mean, there's a book by Antero Pitila called The Ghosts of John Hopkins. You see them experimenting on black people in Baltimore, in Johns Hopkins, doing everything from having cadavers that are three-fourths of the cadavers they spent on in Johns Hopkins are black people. A third of those are black women. And then you see them, when you get to Johns Hopkins, they say, well, if you're indigent black, you can be treated here. But they experiment on black people, and they say, well, that's the price you pay for being indigent and getting health care here. And while they're at it, they're talking about who should and shouldn't reproduce. And you have people like H.L. Mencken, the journalist, who joins with Sanger and others and say, some people too dumb to reproduce. So you need to just destroy their capacity to reproduce. So ironically, finally, you also see some folks in the black community, particularly the black elite, who are saying, well, we have to encourage a higher moral standard in our community and better behavior. So perhaps we should help people deal with family planning. And one of the options we might have is to curtail the number of children they have. I mean, there are class elements in this as well. When you have some of the black elite who call themselves policing black people who are lower in the social economic order. So all that's the part of the very complicated history of the assault on black and non-white populations in this country, which makes our suspicion of vaccines very rational.
And my engineer was just bringing up that Latino immigrants also in the year 2020, there have been reports that there have been forced sterilizations in detention centers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That is absolutely consistent with federal policy. In fact, you quoted the Pew study. You know, there was a study done with the COVID Collaborative, co-founded by the Harvard Dean of Public Health, Michelle Williams. Langer Research carried it out. And fewer than half of black respondents said they'd get a coronavirus vaccine, even if it was free. Only 14% of Black people trust it'll be safe, and less than 20% trust it will be effective. Now, the Latino community, the numbers are higher, but once again, what is a Latino? Because they're lumping in the white Latinos. So, I mean, I suspect among Afro-Latinos, that number would also be high, and also Chicanos and other non-white Spanish-speaking population, not to mention Native Americans.
And so if we can get into also dealing with smallpox, the raids that happened in the 1900s where there's the smallpox epidemic that swept across the country, reports that in New York and Boston in particular, policemen conducted several raids and forced people to get vaccinated. Also, there's an example in the book Pox, in American History, professor of history at Brandeis University, Michael Wilrich, said that there was an incident in Millsboro, Kentucky, where police and a group of vaccinators went into an African-American section of town, rounded up people, and vaccinated them at gunpoint.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is all part of that larger quarantinist philosophy toward Black and brown folk in this country, meaning you must control this population. And your approach to their health care has everything to do with you maintaining this sanitationist philosophy. We have to protect ourselves. So when it is fortuitous to vaccinate people who are not white, you do it. When it's fortuitous to declare them immune, you do it. You mentioned smallpox in the 20th century. We can go back to the yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793. At that time, the capital of the country was in Philadelphia. Even George Washington left Philly. 17,000 people got ill. 5,000 died. And what did they do in Philadelphia? They declared the Blacks immune and made them bury the people who were dying of smallpox. Hundreds of Black people died during the period. And to this day, they say, well, Black people saved the city of Philadelphia. Not because we wanted to, because they declared us immune to make us do that dirty work. Fast forward to what you just mentioned. And on the other side of it, if there's a national health threat, then the idea becomes, well, you know, we need Black folk to step up and get these vaccinations because it's going to help the country. Black people looking like, yeah, there was an article about a month ago in the New York Times. They sent folks into the Hill District of Pittsburgh and to tell Black people you should participate in these trials. You know, the vaccine is coming. Black folks looking at them like, yeah, nah, I'm good. In fact, a poignant moment in that conversation, which leads us to the solution stage, I think, in part. A sister asked this other sister who was coming out telling people they need to get inoculated. He said, did you take the shot? Are you part of the trial? And this sister said, yes, I am. That softened a bit the attitude, because at the end of the day, there's no good choice. Our choice is between the devil and the deep blue sea. Mm. In other words, do you submit to the vaccine or do you submit to sickness and death with no vaccine? Because remember, of the 21 million or so frontline healthcare workers in this country, many of them are Black and brown. And then the rest of the essential workers in this country, overwhelmingly poor folks, many Black and brown. Are people going to choose to roll up their sleeves to try to prevent this? Or are they going to continue to go out with no guarantee, no promise of even potential protection, and subject themselves to that risk? And it's a Hobson's choice in some ways. There's no really good choice.
We are speaking with Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, speaking about the history of distrust of vaccines by the African-American community. And I wanted to make a disclaimer that I'm not in any way trying to say anything negative about vaccines, or I'm not an anti-vaxxer or anything like that. I just wanted to bring up the real reason why Black people don't trust vaccines. And I wanted to give a personal example of me. My mom is an RN, trained in Western medicine. So as a child, I had all those shots. she was not playing. Measles, whooping cough, hepatitis. And one interesting thing, though, was that I did have a Black doctor as a child. And I don't know if I can ask her, but I don't know if that was intentional on my mother's part. And I was reading a writer from the L.A. Times, Erica D. Smith, mentioned that there are many studies that show that black people tend to have better outcomes when treated by trusted black doctors. But there were only 2.6% of the nation's physicians were black as of last year. And so that's an issue as well.
Oh, that's a huge issue. That's a huge issue. In fact, there's a reason why we see black healthcare leaders stepping up. Ernest Grant, president of the American Nurses Association, is participating in the Moderna vaccine trial. And he says that about 10% of those participants are black. You've seen the HBCU medical school presidents at my institution, Howard University, Wayne Frederick. You have James Hildreth, who in my hometown, Meharry Medical College, who is himself an epidemiologist, said, yeah, I'll be the first to participate in the trial. The leaders of Morehouse School of Medicine and out there on the West Coast, you know, Charles Drew School of Medicine. They're saying we have to do this. And that is key. That is a key moment. You have to have black folk and folks who look like the communities who are most vulnerable step up to say, you know, I'll do it. And in fact, you know, some of the poll results, the same poll we were talking about earlier, the poll that Harvard participated in, 55% of black folk know somebody with COVID. Almost half knew somebody's been hospitalized or passed. Those numbers are actually higher among the Latinos poll, 79% and 52% respectively. Black folk, according to this research, are twice as likely to trust a black messenger than a white one. And that's just common sense. So it's a personal position. If it's your mother, and you know, I'm from Tennessee, where I'm from, you couldn't go to school right. If you didn't have your vaccine. And so finally, you know, again, this isn't about anti-vaxxers. I'm sure you've seen in the last couple of days, Letitia Wright, who played Shuri in Black Panther, you know, is being attacked because she reposted something that talked about being suspicious of vaccines. And it happened to come from a kind of guy who's considered a religious or faith leader. Mm-hmm. And so there is an element that says, you know, we're just going to trust God. And listen, that's another conversation, as we know. But it isn't about anti-vaxxers, as you say. This is, I think you want, I want, what we all want is the same thing. We have to keep our people safe. And in this country, our experience from the time the first woman and man set their foot on these shores is we have been unsafe. So this is rational, a rational response, and it has to be approached with that in mind.
And the other side of it is access to the vaccine. Mm-hmm. When there is a rollout, and there's no easy win. I mean, the first option is if counties roll it out equally, ignoring Black, Latino, and Indigenous populations getting COVID-19 at higher rates, they'll be accused of it that won't be equality. Then if they target Black people, they'll be accused of experimenting on Black people if they give it to Black people first. So there's really no way to win in that sense.
That's right. That's right.
What are your thoughts on that? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we face the twin pandemic in many ways. You know, obviously COVID-19 is just reinforced the fact of the pre-existing pandemic, which Reverend Raphael Warnock, running for Senate in Georgia, and many others refer to as COVID-16-19. In other words, you know, in other words, there is no good way to approach this, because what it is underscoring for the rest of the country and reminding us of is this is a white nationalist settler experiment. So if you do, I mean, and you've underscored it again, Janine, beautifully, you know, our people are most at risk. So we should, if there is an effective vaccine, be given access to it first. And in fact, one of the messages that was being spread in Pittsburgh as folks were out, these are black and brown people talking to black and brown people. People said, you know, a sister said, I'm not going to be a guinea pig. And the sister from the medical community said, listen, you're not going to be the guinea pig. White people are. So what we see is the commingling of fates. So that's why it was important to get black people in the trial phase for these vaccines, because when you start talking about pre-existing conditions, when you start talking about obesity, when you start talking about hypertension, when you start talking about these comorbid conditions, if you haven't tested the vaccine with enough of us, then we don't know what will happen when it is administered to us. And that would just reinforce the suspicion. And finally, at the end of the day, if this is going to be rolled out, and we're seeing seeing now the CDC, and of course, I wouldn't trust Alex Azar. Well, that's not true. I could throw Alex Azar farther than I would trust him, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. But we see the recommendations is get it to the folks in the nursing homes, get it to the people who are on the front lines. And of course, a lot of those people are going to be black and brown, the people who are working in those places. And we're just going to see finally a global kind of suspicion until we are past this thing. We know England, for example, is going to be rolling out the vaccine very quickly. They've already ordered 40 million doses in the UK. We know the continent of Africa with 1.3 billion people, well over half of them under 20 years of age, are being told that over the next several years, 60% of the population needs to be inoculated. And of course, we haven't even mentioned the AIDS and how the suspicion toward where AIDS came from and where these non-governmental organizations dealing with healthcare in Africa, the suspicion of them. You know, but at the end of the day, we are the most vulnerable. So I don't think there's a good answer to what you've raised. We're just going to have to, you know, do our best to try to make our best educated approach to try to protect ourselves.
And I'm glad you brought up that AIDS example. That was one thing I was going to share, too, that I remember Sister Soldier saying in a speech that at one point in Africa, the AIDS cases were very low. Then European doctors came in, and then everybody had AIDS. Now, that's not a scientific study, but that it does speak to what some people would call a conspiracy theory of just being a little cautious about large groups of Western doctors coming in Africa with needles.
Being very cautious. And we both remember that, Janine, of course, being coming of age during the golden age of hip hop. You know, I remember a pamphlet being circulated on the East Coast called Who Killed Africa? Who, meaning the World Health Organization. And the whole idea that the AIDS was created at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and that it was part of a weaponized kind of a biological weapon. And it came out later that the Soviet Union had been part of the kind of spreading that propaganda, but that Fort Detrick did operate a bioweapons program during World War II, and it experimented with defensive bioweapons research since then. Weapon delivery systems like mosquitoes. I mean, so at the end of the day, yes, a lot of it might be conspiracy theory, but guess what? A conspiracy theory based in the experience of your people isn't something that can be discounted, particularly when your life is at stake. And of course, we're just old enough to remember when AIDS was basically branded as a crisis, as a white gay male disease, when in fact, the majority of people who were suffering with HIV and then full-blown AIDS were non-white people, black and brown communities. And so, you know, there's a healthy suspicion of state intervention on behalf of black and brown populations because it has never been altruistic in our experience, either here or on the continent.
And when we were speaking about black doctors being the ones to calm black fears about the vaccines, Obama addressed that. The concerns recently, the distrust, saying that he would be vaccinated, have it videotaped or on screen. What are your thoughts about Obama saying that he would take the vaccine publicly?
Well, to be charitable to Barack Obama, I will say that the 44th president of the United States is someone who we should listen to alongside everyone else in context. Whatever he shot with will be like what Donald Trump got here at Walter Reed. So not really worried about it. Now the question is, am I going to get what you got? And I don't care how many times you take, because, you know, Barack Obama is not a black leader. He was the president of the United States. And the next time he opens his mouth, either in print or in public, and starts talking about anything like attacking my friend Jeremiah Wright or telling black folk and other people we shouldn't be talking about defund the police, right, he will get down further down the peg, if he can get any further, in my mind, in terms of people who'd be listened to.
Right.
Finally,
agreed.
Any man that would go to, or woman, any person who would go to Flint, Michigan, as the president of the United States, and pretend that the water is safe by drinking out a glass of water is not somebody I'm going to look at because they videotaped somebody shooting something in his arm and say, okay, let me go. The man has no credibility. He has demonstrated over and over again that as an agent of the state, he is going to do what's in the best interest of the state. So that's no shade on Barack Obama. I'm just saying you're a president. And just like you shouldn't be on a T-shirt with Rosa Parks or Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, we should listen to you the same way we listen to Joe Biden or Donald Trump or any other president. You got another agenda, bro, and the color of your skin doesn't negate that fact.
Exactly. Is there anything else that you would like to add about African-Americans and vaccination or the history of it? We have about 1 minute.
No, sis, I would just say this. I appreciate you sharing your personal experience. And I think women like your mother, women and men like our healthcare providers, this is a point when we really need them to voice their expertise and their experience, because our people are in harm's way. And all we want is to not be in harm's way. So we really need those folks who know about this kind of thing to step up and help us, because we're choosing between the devil and the deep blue sea. And this is not a good choice. So we're going to need our people who know to intervene. I appreciate you calling me, sis.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, speaking about African-American distrust of vaccines. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, sis. Stay safe.
Yes, sir.